Joshua chapter 4, and we take up the reading at verse 1. When the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, "Choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priests are standing, and carry them over with you, and put them down at the place where you stay tonight." So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, "Go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder, according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever."
Just a few remarks to begin. Oliver Cromwell is a figure of compelling fascination. And neutrality is difficult. English people have their instinctive sympathies, whether for king or parliament, cavalier or roundhead, Anglican or Puritan, King Charles or Oliver Cromwell. And to some, Cromwell will always be the despoiler of churches, the ogre who hounded the saintly King Charles I to his death. His name is still used as a curse in Ireland, where he has become a monster of almost mythical proportions. But to others, he will always be the no-nonsense soldier and statesman who exemplified in his life his own belief that nobility has more to do with character than birthright. The champion of limited constitutional government and liberty of conscience. It's all the more remarkable then to reflect that only the final third of his life was spent as a public figure. The first two-thirds of his life were spent as a poor gentleman farmer on the edge of the Fen country in East Anglia. And for that reason, his admirers during his own lifetime liked to think of him as England's David, prepared for great things during a lengthy apprenticeship in obscurity. So let's begin with that title, England's David. And we're looking at the years from his birth in 1599 to 1642. He was born on the 25th of April, 1599, in the early hours of the morning to Robert and Elizabeth Cromwell in Huntingdon, and he was one of 10 children. 7 of those survived to adulthood, and of those he was the only boy. Various rumours have grown up surrounding his birth. One of them is that the room where he was born was adorned with a tapestry of the devil, which therefore exerted a strong postnatal influence on his character. Make what you will of that. Another concerns the fact that his mother's maiden name was Elizabeth Stuart, the original spelling of the royal surname Stuart. Now, because of this, the idea took hold that Cromwell might have been a distant relative of the king whose nemesis he eventually became. Now, this was based on a fabricated story that a Scottish prince was shipwrecked on the coast of Norfolk in 1406. There's no truth in that rumour, and Elizabeth was actually descended not from the Stuarts of Scotland, but from the Stewards of Calais in France. The Cromwells were at that time minor nobility, although Oliver was born into the junior branch of the family, who lived in the shadow of the family patriarch, Oliver's uncle, who was Sir Oliver. He probably was named after him. Sir Oliver was in fact his godfather, and Sir Oliver eventually beggared himself by offering lavish hospitality on several occasions to the new King James I, he of the King James Bible, who was on his way to London to claim his crown as King of England. And there's a long-standing but unproven story that the young Oliver was present on this occasion, and that he and Prince Charles, who later became King Charles I, got into a tussle, and that the future Lord Protector bloodied the nose of the future monarch. But going further back, and this is true, one of Cromwell's paternal ancestors was a Welshman named Morgan Williams, one of several intrepid Welshmen who hoped to better themselves by following the Welsh monarch Henry VII into England. And in due course, he was to marry a Catherine Cromwell, who was sister to Henry VIII's Chancellor, Thomas Cromwell. You've seen Wolf Hall on the television? Well, her surname was more illustrious than his. The Cromwell name was rising at that time. So he adopted the Cromwell surname, and a Celtic strand in Cromwell's ancestry may help to explain a measure of emotional intensity and passion unusual in an Englishman. Well, at any rate, young Oliver grew up in Huntingdon against the backdrop of a family that was struggling to maintain its position in the social order. His uncle, as you've heard, had beggared himself effectively by entertaining the king on several occasions. There was a modest farm and a family brewery in Huntingdon, but neither of these operations did well. And Cromwell was to say in later life, "I was by birth a gentleman, living neither in any considerable height nor yet in obscurity." The Cromwell stock had sunk so low that by 1631 he sold the house in which he'd been born and took on the tenancy of a farm in nearby St. Ives. That's not the one in Cornwall, it's in Huntingdonshire. And he was never financially secure until the death of his maternal uncle, Sir Thomas Steward, in 1636, when he inherited an estate in Ely. If ever you were to go to Ely, you can visit what was his house there, and it's been turned into a fine museum of Cromwell and his life there. Now, as a promising commander of cavalry in later years, Cromwell developed a policy of recruiting a type of person that he identified as a plain, russet-coated captain. Now, by this, he simply meant people of his own kind. And in later life, when explaining his approach to the government of a whole country, he didn't compare himself to a justice of the peace, that was too exalted, but just to a parish constable. And that will give you some idea of the social background that he had emerged from. But he was, and this is important, born and raised in the heartland of English Puritanism. He attended grammar school in Huntingdon, and during his teens had a brief spell at Sidney Sussex College in Cambridge, which at that time was essentially a seminary for training Puritan ministers. He gave an early evidence of a lifelong boisterous streak when he mounted his horse from a first floor window of the college above Sydney Street in Cambridge. He was to leave the university on the death of his father in 1617. A key event was his marriage in August 1620 to a lady named Elizabeth Borgia at St. Giles Cripplegate. At 23, she was 2 years older than he was and from a slightly more prosperous family. She was at that time a pretty girl, and Oliver's favourite daughter, Betty, was the one who looked most like her mother. Not a natural extrovert, Elizabeth had hidden depths to her personality, and during the Protectorate, when she was by that stage an overweight matriarch, she became the butt of royalist satire and propaganda, but Oliver remained devoted to her through over 30 years of marriage and she to him. When his life was at its most crowded, amid the frantic bustle of military campaigns, he took time to write affectionate little notes to her. After 31 years of marriage, he could write like this: "My dearest, I could not satisfy to omit this post, although I have not much to write, yet indeed I love to write to my dear, who is very much in my heart." On the morning after his greatest victory at the Battle of Dunbar, he wrote, "Thou art dearer to me than any creature," meaning by that, than any other thing in all creation. She, for her part, was to write to him, "Truly, my life is but half a life in your absence." Marriage seems to have calmed him down. He had a wild streak during his youth, although in later years he was rather apt to paint his pre-conversion days in more lurid colours than he really need have done. As a youth, he was nicknamed the Apple Dragon for his habit of raiding orchards and scrumping on the apples that he found there. He was always a country boy at heart, and for the rest of his days he enjoyed strenuous physical activity and was always glad of time to follow the rural sports of the day. He could not always suppress a liking for rumbustious horseplay, and in later years would sometimes find release from the tedium of council meetings by hurling cushions at the heads of the ministers of state, or by engaging in playful bouts of wrestling. Now, whether Mr. Johnson gets up to that sort of behaviour in cabinet meetings, I can't imagine. At some point between 1628 and 1636, Oliver underwent an evangelical conversion. The precise timing is difficult to determine, but it's clear that he passed through a period of intense depression, even seeking the help of a noted London doctor, Sir Theodore Mayne, who recorded that he found Cromwell extremely melancholy. It's probable that this was the profound conviction of personal sin and guilt common to those on the brink of conversion to Christ. One formative influence, probably during his years in St. Ives, was a man named Dr. Walter Wells, formerly lecturer in Godmanchester, just across the river from Huntingdon. Now, by the way, when you hear someone in the Puritan period described as a lecturer, this was a way of bypassing the parish system. If your parish minister was not an evangelical, and not a preaching minister, then Puritan merchants with a bit of money would often pay a man a salary to give lectures. In other words, basically to preach, but not within the structures of the parochial system. And Cromwell wrote to a friend about Dr. Wells that he was a man for goodness and industry and ability to do good every way, not short of any I know in England. And I'm persuaded that thence his coming, the Lord hath by him wrought much good amongst us. Well, at any rate, he eventually arrived at a stable assurance of salvation. And it's interesting to observe his reaction to the death of his oldest son, Robert, who was a promising and godly boy of 17 in the year 1639. He quoted St. Paul, "I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. I know both how to be debased and how to abound. I can do all things through Christ that strengtheneth me." He was to say in later life that Robert's death had been like a dagger through his heart, but that scripture had saved his life. Now, it's not easy to arrive at an assessment of Cromwell's inner life. He doesn't seem to have kept a diary or a commonplace book, which was not unusual for Puritans of that period. Or if he did, these have not survived. So from a man who must have listened to hundreds, if not thousands, of sermons, we've no observations from his pen about the identities of his favourite preachers. And given that he lived at a time when England was favoured with a galaxy of preaching talent, this is all the more frustrating. And in the same way, there's an almost complete absence of any comment, favourable or otherwise, about particular sermons that he heard. We don't know which exhortations moved him, his passionate soul, which words of comfort gave him new heart, or, for that matter, which observations might have left him completely flat. He lived at a time when there was a growing body of exegetical and devotional literature, but we don't know who his favourite spiritual authors were. He was not, it seems, a bookish man, though he had a lifelong attachment to Sir Walter Raleigh's History of the World. Perhaps the best clue to his spiritual maturity is found in his letters to his children. On the 25th of October, 1646, he wrote to his daughter Bridget, who had been married in the January of that year to Henry Ireton, who was a general in the Parliamentary army. "Dear daughter, I write not to thy husband, partly to avoid trouble, for one line of mine begets many of his." You got the sense of that, you know, if I write a letter to your husband, he drowns me in print. "Which, I doubt not, makes him sit up too late." But this is the important bit. "Whoever tasted that the Lord is gracious, without some sense of self, vanity, and badness. Whoever tasted that graciousness of his, and could go less in desire, less pressing after full enjoyment. Dear heart, press on. Let not thy husband, let not anything, cool thy affections after Christ. I hope he, that is thy husband, will be an occasion to inflame them. That which is best worthy of love in thy husband is that of the image of Christ he bears. Look on that and love it best, and all the rest for that. I pray for thee and for him, do so for me." Now, Henry Ireton died of plague in November 1651. So Bridget married again, and Cromwell wrote to her new husband, Charles Fleetwood, in a way that suggests that he understood both the varieties of Christian experience and his own daughter very well. "Salute your dear wife from me. Bid her beware of a bondage spirit. Fear is the natural issue of such a spirit. The antidote is love. The voice of fear speaks like this: if only I had done this, if only I had avoided that, how well it would have been with me. I know this have been her vain reasoning. Love argueth in this wise: what a Christ have I! What a Father in and through him! What a name hath my Father! Merciful, gracious, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth, forgiving iniquity, transgression, and sin. What a nature hath my Father! He is love, free in it, unchangeable, infinite. What a covenant between him and Christ for all the seed, for every one, wherein he undertakes all and the poor soul nothing. Now, I have to say that I'm quite at a loss to understand how those who doubt Cromwell's Christianity can account for the way that he wrote to his children. Now, that brings us, I think, to the causes for the English Civil War, which is probably better referred to as the Wars of the Three Kingdoms. They were complex, but I think I'd like to focus on two main strands. Firstly, was King Charles I's personal style of government. Charles was a short man, just 5'4", and he retained a slight Scottish accent from his father. He was a devout man in his way, a principled man in his way, but rather distant. And he found it difficult to inspire loyalty in his closest associates. Like his father, King James VI of Scotland and first of England, he believed that kings were accountable to God alone. And his style was therefore aloof and paternalistic. And that did not suit a rising class of vigorous and talented members of the minor nobility and gentry, who were hoping that there could be a partnership in government. And the fact that the king failed to consult them and ruled when he could without parliament and therefore without their consent alienated those people. Both sides in the quarrel appealed to history. Each side had its own analysis of the past. Charles could point to the example of many kings who had a short way with unruly subjects, who took too much upon themselves, while his opponents invoked Magna Carta to establish their belief that there was a well-founded tradition in England that kings should only rule with consent. And they would even refer pointedly to what they called the Norman yoke, arguing right back to the Norman conquest, saying that that had obliterated a better and older England, where the king was drawn from among the ranks of the people and ruled again with their consent, as first among equals. Now, the issue that brought matters to a head was taxation. Government, then as now, was expensive. The issue of the magic money tree, it crops up regularly, doesn't it? Governments make promises, but you wonder where the money's going to come from. And Parliament was determined to insist on its ancient right that no taxation should be levied until an acceptable programme of legislation had been agreed. We won't allow you to raise taxes to go and fight wars against such and such nations until you agree that we can carry out these programmes of legislation, Your Majesty. Now, one of these taxes was a tax called ship money, which the king felt he could raise without Parliament's permission. It was traditionally a tax raised by counties on the coast to raise funds for the navy, but Charles pulled a fast one and he started insisting that even counties that were inland should pay it. Now, the second issue was Charles' religious policy. In the year 1633, he'd appointed a new Archbishop of Canterbury, a man named William Laud, and this was highly contentious. William Lord, like his master, was a small man, small and short in stature, and he was what was called at that time an Arminian, but that word had a somewhat different meaning then to the meaning it has today. It meant that he believed in the place of tradition in the church, that he began a systematic policy of restoring pre-Reformation practices into the English church. At the Reformation, communion tables had been moved from the east end of churches into the nave. Lord moved them back and used the old terminology of altar and had them railed off and elevated. He restored the use of stained glass windows, statuary, priestly vestments for the clergy, and he talked a great deal of what he called the beauty of holiness. Now, to the Puritans, they figured that actually he was fixated on the holiness of beauty, that it was things that you could look at and things you could sense and feel that really mattered to him, and not the preaching of God's word. And the Puritans felt that what he was up to was a sinister conspiracy to re-Catholicise the Church of England. And it became more apparent when bishoprics became vacant, when he started to pack them with his own sympathisers. And it didn't help that the king had married a French princess, Henrietta Maria, and allowed her a private chapel where her own priests could celebrate Mass. Now, we need to get hold of how that felt in early 17th century England, because this was only half a generation after the Gunpowder Plot, only a generation after the Spanish Armada. And the idea that the king himself should marry a woman who was conducting idolatrous worship within the palace was regarded as being something well beyond the pale. Now, this was the backdrop to the Puritan settlement of New England. And Puritans felt that they were the victims of intensifying persecution. And Cromwell actually himself thought seriously about emigrating to the New World. At first, during the unhappy period when he was in St. Ives in the early 1630s, and again in November 1641. All of this came to a head when King Charles tried to enforce the policies of Archbishop Laud on the Church of Scotland. And reactions there were even more robust than they'd been in England. The attempt to impose an Anglican prayer book and bishops on a church which saw these things, if you like, as the thin end of a Roman wedge were disastrous. And almost as one, the Scots framed what they called the National Covenant of 1638. This document that was signed by many of the leading Scots nobles in blood was seen as a national covenant with God to defend their church against heavy-handed impositions from outside. Now, Charles then tried to impose these reforms by force, and it led to two short wars, which are known as the Bishops' Wars, and they led to humiliating defeats. Puritan opinion in England was very concerned by this. The Puritans felt considerable sympathy with the Scots and hated the idea that they might either be conscripted to go north and fight them, or alternatively that they might have to pay taxes to fund a war against them. And late in 1640, Charles summoned Parliament to raise money for his campaign against the Scots. This Parliament was called the Long Parliament. It lasted right from 1640 to 1653. Now, think of that when you think we have elections almost every 5 minutes nowadays. and it was in no mood to support Charles' policies. Confidence broke down on both sides. Parliament became increasingly restive when it was rumoured that Charles meant to raise an army of Catholic Irish and bring them over to support his policies. And as trust broke down, Charles left his capital, convinced that London had become ungovernable and that drastic measures were needed. In August 1642, at Nottingham, he raised his standard. This was a traditional gesture, calling loyal subjects to his side to support him against these rebellious people in Parliament. Now, if you have a liking for omens, well, just consider this. The day was wet, the standard was heavy, and later in the day it fell over. Parliament concluded from this, though, that the king was making war on his own subjects. Now, what of Cromwell in all this? Well, he had already served a term as a member for Huntingdon in the Parliament of 1628, and by now he was a member for Cambridge. At this stage, he was in his early 40s, a sturdy man of medium height, which at that stage meant that he was about 5'7". He had lovely eyes, but a prominent nose, which royalist cartoonists later made considerable fun of. His complexion was florid, and three sizable warts meant that his face was rugged rather than handsome. A royalist chronicler, Philip Warwick, had this to say: "I came into the house well clad. We courtiers valued ourselves much upon our good clothes, and perceived a gentleman speaking whom I knew not, very ordinarily apparelled, for it was a plain cloth suit which seemed to have been made by an ill country tailor. His linen was plain and not very clean, and I remember a speck or two of blood upon his little band, which was not much larger than his collar. His hat was without a hat band. His stature was of a good size. His sword stuck close to his side. His countenance swollen and reddish. His sharp voice sharp and untunable, and his eloquence full of fervour. He was very much hearkened unto." Well, that brings us to Cromwell the soldier. When war broke out, he was almost 43, with no military experience. Now, by the way, almost nobody in England had any military experience. There had not been a major war for a very long time, and only a tiny handful of English people who'd served as mercenaries in what was known as the 30 Years' War that was taking place on the continent had any military experience at all. Now, Cromwell was involved in military activity for the best part of a decade, and I'm only going to cover that in quite a cursory way, but let me just mention one or two things. The first major engagement of the war was a battle at a place called Edge Hill, which is in Warwickshire, near a village called Kyneton. Now, Cromwell arrived late, but he did observe something that was highly significant, which was that the Royalist cavalry, which was led by the nephew of King Charles, Prince Rupert of the Rhine, had the effect of smashing through the parliamentary ranks. But then it lost control and went on a looting spree in the village of Kyneton. Cromwell saw this and thought hard about it, and he decided that cavalry could be decisive on the battlefield. But if it was going to be decisive, it would have to be kept under control. So he went away, and he decided to recruit his own cavalry. And he began to raise what became known as the Army of the Eastern Association. He started, in other words, to raise troopers from the shires of eastern England. Now, he deliberately had two things in mind when he did so. He wanted to choose men who had a personal stake in the conflict, men who were committed to evangelical religion. And he willingly accepted soldiers from more modest backgrounds than was usual. As he put it, "I'd rather have a plain, russet-coated captain that knows what he fights for and loves what he knows than that which you call a gentleman and is nothing else. I honour a gentleman that is so indeed." So it's not surprising that Cromwell was able to develop an easy rapport with men like that. He was one himself. It's also clear that some of his recruits came from strands of Puritanism that were still not entirely accepted in English religious life at this stage. I'm referring to people known as Baptists. Now, you may have Baptists among your friends, and you may well understand that they're very dangerous people. But there was no consensus in the early years of the 17th century that they were part of the evangelical mainstream. Their opponents referred to them by the pejorative term Anabaptist. It didn't help, actually, that over a century before, in 1533 to 34, a German city called Münster had been briefly taken over by an extreme faction of Anabaptists who announced that it was the New Jerusalem and tried to force shared property and polygamy on the city. It was rather like the incident that happened in Jonestown in Guyana in the late 1970s, if some of you can recall that. But even so, by the 1640s, most English Baptists, if I can put it that way, were actually Calvinistic Puritans of independent rather than Presbyterian views, who came to the additional conclusion on top of that, that Christian baptism was for believers only. Cromwell's response, when someone complained that he was recruiting people like that for the army, rather suspect human material in their view, was, "Aye, but the man is an Anabaptist. Are you sure of that? Admit he be. Shall that render him incapable to serve the public? Sir, the state, in choosing men to serve them, takes no notice of their opinions. If they be willing faithfully to serve them, that satisfies." Now, I would sum it up this way, that Cromwell's pragmatism in recruiting troops for the Army of the Eastern Association really amounts to the answers to two questions. Is he godly? Can he fight? Now, the value of Cromwell's recruitment policy was proved at a battle that took place at Marston Moor, just outside of York, in 1644. To sum it up, what had happened is that the Earl of Newcastle had raised a traditional regiment. By traditional, I mean he'd summoned his feudal levies, dressed them in white uniforms, marched them south to York, and they'd got trapped inside the city by parliamentary armies. Prince Rupert had come north to try to relieve them, but Cromwell and the Army of the Eastern Association had discovered them there. The battle was a matter of 50-50, really, for most of the day, until Cromwell had gone off to Knaresborough to have a sword cut in his neck stitched. And when he returned, he found that his cavalry was still in good shape, and after charge after ponderous charge, they soon dispatched all of their opposition. The Earl of Newcastle's white coats refused to surrender and were slaughtered to a man. Oh, now, here's the thing. Just to tell you something, by the way, about an ancient rivalry. You've already got it worked out that the Earl of Newcastle supported the king. you really ought to understand that Sunderland supported Parliament in that conflict. quite right, too. Now, Oliver's star was in the ascendant here. The next major engagement took place at Naseby in 1645 in Leicestershire, and shortly after that, the king was, having been heavily defeated, fled to the Scots, who handed him over to Parliament. Now, a tense period of negotiations followed. What was to be done with the king now that they've got him, now that they've captured him? Well, unfortunately, the king began to negotiate with the Scots, who, having at first fought with Parliament, then started to change their minds and take the side of the king, because the king promised that he would respect the national covenant that the Scots had made and agree with the introduction of Presbyterianism in England if they would only take his side. There's good reason to suppose he was being completely insincere in that, and that he was just playing both sides against the middle, as it were, in the hope that he could spin things out. But the Scots had to be dealt with. They had invaded England, and a battle was fought at Preston, which was a complete victory. Now, a tense period followed. What was to be done with the king? Now, Cromwell had reluctantly come to share the conclusion of many people in the army that Charles was not only a man of blood who had waged war on his own people, a dissembler who could not be trusted to negotiate in good faith, but a man whose heart God had hardened, like the biblical Pharaoh. Had he not secretly plotted to bring down the army of a foreign power? That, of course, is how the Scots would have been perceived back in the middle of the 17th century. And by the way, if Mrs. Sturgeon gets her way, that is how our neighbours will be perceived again in a century from now, which would be the most enormous tragedy from my point of view. Now, this posed an acute dilemma for Christian people. What did David do when faced by Saul? Unreliable and shifty Saul, because for all his faults he was the Lord's anointed. Now, on the other hand, many Puritans agreed with John Calvin's analysis. Look at the Institutes, Book 4, Chapter 40, and you can check on this. The powers that be are ordained of God, Romans 13, right? And every soul is to be obedient to the higher powers. But what if God has ordained not only that a nation should have a king, but that there are lesser powers beneath the monarch to restrain the monarch and keep checks and balances within the system? And as well as Calvin, other Reformed authors had written on this theme. A French scholar named Philippe Duplessis-Mornay had written a book called Vindicii Contra Tyrannos. The Latin means vindication against tyrants. What are Christians to do if they're living under a tyrant, as many of the French Huguenots had been? Now, an analogy that was frequently used was this. Suppose father comes home drunk one evening and starts to beat his wife. And if he has strong sons at home who are almost fully grown, is it not their duty at that point to restrain their father for the sake of their mother's well-being until their father is in a better mind? Until he sobers up next day and comes to himself and realizes what a fool he's been. Nobody would blame two 18-year-old lads living in the home who grappled with their dad and said, "Dad, stop it. You're hurting Mum." Now, there was already a consensus by this stage in the army that Charles should be brought to account. Perhaps one of the most fateful prayer meetings in the whole of British history took place in April 1648, when the General Council of the Army met at Windsor. Surely the Scots invasion of that year indicated God's displeasure with his people in England, and the time had come to seek God's face and determine the reasons for that. And as the meeting wore on, the conviction gained ground that the Lord was displeased that Parliament had negotiated with the King the previous year. And at this stage, a decisive intervention came from a man named William Gough, who quoted from the scripture, from Proverbs 1:23, "Turn you at my reproof." And that scripture contains the warning that if the elect people of God will not turn, that God would laugh at their calamity. But if they did turn, he would pour out his spirit upon them. So the meeting resolved to renew the conflict with fresh vigour. And secondly, if the Lord ever brought us back again in peace, to call Charles Stuart to an account for the blood that he had shed. Well, in the meantime, Cromwell himself had been held up at the siege of a minor castle at Pontefract. You know, Pontefract, the home of licorice. It's an interesting word. It means broken bridge. Cromwell often did this. He liked to adopt what he called a waiting posture so that he could spend the time in prayer and seeking the mind of God. But then he addressed the House of Commons on December the 26th, 1648. Boxing Day. It wasn't a day off in Puritan England. And he declared, "If any man moved this upon design, he should think him the greatest traitor in the world. But since providence and necessity had cast them upon it, he should pray God to bless their counsels." And the trial of the king began in Westminster Hall. That's the oldest building in the Palace of Westminster. It dates back to the days of King William Rufus. And there was no precedent for an event like that in the whole of English history. And there were those who were convinced, of course, that it was not legitimate. A man named Algernon Sidney refused to serve as one of the judges. First, the king can be tried by no court. Secondly, no man can be tried by this court. Charles, for his part, behaved with more resolution and more dignity than at any time in his life, steadfastly refusing to acknowledge that the court had any right to try him. He behaved with impeccable dignity and did much to create the cult of the royal martyr, which is beloved of high Anglicans to this day. His execution on the 30th of January 1649 was a strangely muted affair. And by the way, there's no truth in the rumour that Cromwell crept into the mortuary to gloat over the body of his royal adversary. You know, there's an old story to that effect, but there's nothing in it. Now, England had become a republic by default, but there were still military matters to clear up. There was a campaign in Ireland, which is extremely contentious, and a campaign in Scotland, but I'm not going to deal with them just now because There are other things I'd like to get on to, and you've already been very patient. If you do want to know about those matters, then if there's a question time, ask me about them, and we'll try to clear them up. Well, that brings me then to our next matter. Our title for the remainder is the First Englishman. Cromwell was not really a republican at heart. When he first went to war with the king, it was not with the intention of deposing him, but rather of hoping to bring him to a better mind. But events had conspired to make him the most significant presence in this new and shaky republic known as the Commonwealth. He'd risen to a prominence that no one could challenge. He was the natural person to fill the power vacuum, since he was the only person who could bridge the chasm between Parliament and the parliamentary army. And in the immediate aftermath of Naseby, a radical movement had grown up in the army known as the Levellers. They hoped that victory in the war would mean an opportunity to start afresh with a new kind of England, where, as they put it, the smallest he in England would have a life to live as much as the greatest he. And they proposed a parliament of 400, elected every 2 years, on a much more democratic franchise than had ever been known up till then. Vigorous debates had taken place at Putney between senior generals of the army, including Cromwell, and representatives of the Levellers, but the Leveller programme came to nothing. Cromwell had been in a difficult position through the long wars against the crown, and like any revolution, this one had produced a crop of radicals who wanted to push reform even further than the parliamentarians of 1642 had ever envisaged. And in the event, by the time he became protector of the Commonwealth, he was already an old man by the standards of the time, worn out by his campaigns. And he never rediscovered the clarity of the battlefield in the murky world of politics. And he found it much harder to observe the leadings of Providence there. And in the end, he resigned himself to trying, as he put it, like the good constable, to keep the peace of the parish. He died in 1658, so his rule as Lord Protector was brief. Had he lived for another 10 years or so, and had he been followed by a competent successor, with Charles II marginalised and living on the continent, England might have been a republic to this day. As it is, a number of aspects of his tenure give tantalising glimpses of what might have been. The one area where his government was a resounding failure was that he tried without success to create a workable system of legitimate government for the infant republic. Four parliaments were called, and each of them was dismissed in turn. The first of them was a sincere but counterproductive experiment to try and produce a non-partisan government of evangelicals, a parliament of saints. It was nicknamed the Bare Bones Parliament. The reason was it was named after one of its more colourful figures, a man called Praise God Barebones. Barebones, or Barbon, was his surname. There's an unsubstantiated story, by the way, that this man had two brothers, one called Christ Came Into the World to Save Barebones, and the other If Christ had not died, thou hadst been damned, Barebones. Just imagine Mum calling the boys in for their tea. Now, the Barebones Parliament is a cautionary reminder that it's simplistic to suppose that a legislative body composed entirely of born-again Christians will agree on anything at all except the way of salvation. The failure of the Commonwealth Parliaments may be attributed in part to poor management, but it left a worrying hiatus. With the abolition of monarchy, the new regime was exposed to the charge that it lacked legitimacy. And the only way to confer legitimacy on new institutions was to guarantee stability over a period of time. But this was not forthcoming. His religious policy, on the other hand, was perhaps the greatest of his peacetime achievements. It culminated in a noble and far-sighted attempt to produce a workable national church that would be genuinely evangelical. When civil war broke out in 1642, most English Puritans had been Presbyterian in their sympathies. This had largely been the case since the middle of the previous century. When Queen Elizabeth I ascended the throne, her settlement of the church was a compromise, a thing but halfly reformed in the minds of Puritans, or to describe them as was often done at the time, the hotter sort of Protestants. They looked with envy at Geneva, at the Netherlands, and neighbouring Scotland, and longed for similar reform in their own national church. The passage of time, however, had produced a situation that was far from monochrome. In 1643, an assembly of divines was summoned by Parliament to consider the further reformation of the church. The idea had been mooted 2 years before when the king had still been in London, but he objected in principle, arguing that the church needed no reform. But now, however, Parliament's military alliance with the Scots, called the Solemn League and Covenant, came at a price. And this price would include the abolition of episcopacy, that means rule of the church by bishops, and a programme of reform that would bring the English church more into line with the Scottish church. The Westminster Assembly, as it was called, met mostly in the Jerusalem Chamber of Westminster Abbey and continued until 1653, and it included 5 Scots commissioners, including Samuel Rutherford. It produced a number of remarkable results, including the famous Westminster Confession of Faith and the longer and shorter catechisms, the Directory of Worship. The Assembly's proposals were adopted wholesale in Scotland, but not in England. That's because in the 1630s and 40s, a new grouping had emerged, the Independents. Cromwell himself was an Independent, agreeing in all respects with Presbyterians except over their system of church government. And during the course of the Westminster Assembly, 5 Independent ministers, Thomas Goodwin, Philip Nye, Sidrock Simpson, Jeremiah Burroughs and William Bridge, favoured autonomy for local churches rather than a national Presbyterian system and became known as the Dissenting Brethren, partly because of their stalling tactics and partly because independent views were well represented in the parliamentary army. It proved impossible to create a Presbyterian national church in England. Nevertheless, the Westminster Confession has been adopted by Presbyterian bodies in many parts of the world and likely modified the Congregationalists' use a version of it as their Savoy Declaration, as do particular Baptists with their Second London Confession of 1689. When the monarchy was restored in 1660, this meant that Anglicanism was restored, along with it, prayer book, bishops and all. Now, the abolition of episcopacy lifted the lid off Pandora's box. Suddenly, Englishmen were free to explore all manner of new spiritual options with no danger of a heresy trial at a bishop's consistory court. The yeoman service they'd rendered during the war had also earned a cautious respect for the particular Baptists, an undeniably sober and godly community, despite the disturbing implications of their distinctive doctrine. Further out toward, and in some cases beyond, the evangelical periphery were other groups, such as the Quakers and yet more exotic sects, the Ranters, Fifth Monarchy Men, Seekers, and Muggletonians. The last Muggletonian died in the 1970s. Founded by two men, Ludovic Muggleton and John Reeve, who believed they were the two witnesses of Revelation 11. Reputedly, they at one stage had a hymn which included the verse, "None are saved, so we believe, but those of Muggleton and Reeve. None are saved, but those alone who follow Reeve and Muggleton." It's not great poetry, really, but you get the sense of it, don't you? Now, faced with this sort of situation, Cromwell had two chief concerns. And the first of these places him squarely in the mainstream of Puritan thought ever since the Reformation. He simply longed to see the rise of a godly nation. And this would be secured through what was termed the Reformation of Manners, which would require in its turn, as far as could be achieved, a preaching minister in every parish. And the second concern, though this was not widely shared by his contemporaries, and this marks his distinctive contribution to the spiritual history of England, was his burden for the liberty of conscience. Cromwell is sometimes portrayed by modern authors as a pioneer in the field of religious toleration. Now, we have to be careful here, because to describe him in that way is to be guilty of anachronism. It's to project the present back into the past. He himself would have been unhappy with that kind of description. As Blair Worden, one of his biographers, remarks, more often than not in Puritan England, toleration was a dirty word. It stood not for an edifying principle, but for an impious policy. To grant a toleration was to make an expedient concession to sin and wickedness. God did not tolerate sin or heresy. Heresy was cruel. It took souls to hell. Insufficient rigor might provoke the Almighty. It was to commit the sin of Achan. Cromwell's concern was much more restricted than that. His experiences during the war had provided him with ample proof that the godly were not confined to one party, to one way. A common enemy and shared danger often unites men of different persuasions. And Cromwell's dispatches from the siege of Bristol in 1645 made this a proving point. Presbyterians, independents, all had here the same spirit of faith and prayer, the same presence and answer. They agree here, no known names of difference. Pity it is that it should be otherwise anywhere. So by the end of his military decade, Cromwell had become not so much a promoter or defender of the sects, as he put it, as a man enamoured of godliness, but indifferent to its forms, provided they fell within the limits of mainstream evangelical Trinitarian Protestantism. Now that does need some qualification. His instinctive sympathies lay within the spectrum of Protestant opinion that later became known as Old Dissent after the Restoration. In other words, the Presbyterians, the Independents, and the Particular Baptists. Tolerating Anglicanism, though, was a different matter. Prelacy, as it was then called, in other words, ruled by prelates or bishops, presented an acute dilemma. It was undeniable that some godly people and conscientious, or to use the language of the day, painful ministers. Now, if you hear a Puritan talking about a painful minister, it doesn't mean he's a pain in the neck or something. It means he's painstaking, that he works hard at his calling. That many of these had Anglican sympathies. Oliver so admired the personal godliness of Archbishop Usher, for instance, of Armagh, that he permitted Anglican rites at his funeral, even though the Book of Common Prayer had been outlawed early in the Long Parliament. But in the 1650s, Anglicanism was not viewed just as one form of Protestantism among many. It was viewed as royalism at prayer, if I can put it that way. It was difficult to be neutral about Anglicanism because royalists had gone to war to defend their king, and together with loyalty to King Charles went loyalty to his Laudian bishops and the Book of Common Prayer and the whole rigmarole. So to sum up, Cromwell's essential concern was the unity of the godly. But the godly, on the other hand, as Cromwell had learned, had a distressing propensity for mutual antipathy. Every sect saith, "Oh, give me liberty, but give it to him, and to his power he will not yield it to anybody else." "Truly, that's a thing ought to be very reciprocal," said Cromwell. Cromwell saw his work as to preserve the churches from destroying one another, to keep all the godly of several judgments in peace, because like men falling out in the street, they would run their heads against one another. His role was that of a constable, to part them and keep them in peace. Now, perhaps the most remarkable aspect of all this is the way that Particular Baptists emerged from the shadows. Over the years, there's been some debate about the origins of English Baptists. Should we see them as the lineal descendants of the various Anabaptist groups who emerged on the continent in the years after the Reformation? Actually, it's probably better to see them as a branch of English Puritanism. And to cut a potentially long story short, there are Baptist churches as far afield as Northumberland, Scotland and Ireland, which owe their origins to having been planted by the movement of the parliamentary armies. One of them was founded in Hexham, and you can see the name of its minister, Thomas Tillam, as one of the rectors of the Church of St Wilfrid, if ever you look inside the Abbey Church there. Now, for a man of action who was not a natural scholar, Cromwell had an impressive grasp of theology. He had enough acumen to correct Fifth Monarchists about the identity of the Antichrist. They thought it was him. He disagreed. His religious policy began to take shape when the Vice-Chancellor of Oxford University, John Owen, was asked to head a committee that proposed a solution. Two commissions would be set up. The first was a commission of triers, established in March 1654. It was given the task of appointing ministers for every vacant parish. Applicants would be assessed in terms of their spirituality, conduct, knowledge, and ability to preach. Ordination, the ordinance made quite clear, did not come into it. Whether a person had been ordained by a bishop or a presbytery or simply by the elders of a local congregation was not what was at issue. It was simply fitness to labour in the work of the gospel. And it consisted of 38 men. It included Presbyterians, Independents, and even a small number of Baptists. The other commission of ejectors was established later that same year and had the remit of supervising and removing those who were unfit to be ministers of the gospel. So the idea, you see, was to create a loose national church that would include most evangelical Protestants, but not Roman Catholics or fanatics who expected direct inspiration from the Holy Spirit. Now, Richard Baxter's mature judgment, after the monarchy was restored in 1660, was this: the two commissions did abundance of good to the church. Many thousands of souls blessed God for the faithful ministers whom they let in and grieved when the Protestants afterward cast them out again. Just to mention, by the way, that it was also during the Commonwealth period that Jews began to settle in England once again for the first time in several centuries. As far as we're aware, there was no significant Jewish presence in England prior to the Norman conquest. But William the Conqueror seems to have brought Jews from Rouen to settle in England because of their financial acumen. And their numbers and fortunes grew and fluctuated until the time of the Crusades encouraged an atmosphere of anti-Semitism. In 1290, Edward I expelled what was left of a much depleted Jewish community. By the late 16th century, there were probably small numbers of Jews sort of living under the radar in England as refugees from Spanish persecution. When Sir Francis Drake, for instance, made his voyage round the world, his quartermaster was known as Moses the Jew. Now, in September 1655, after some preliminary soundings, a rabbi from Amsterdam, Manasseh ben Israel, came with three other rabbis to present a petition for the readmittance of Jews to England. A national conference was called at Whitehall to discuss the affair, and Oliver approved on the common sense ground that if the Jews were to be converted and the Lord Jesus Christ's return were to be hastened, where could this happen more than in England, where the pure preaching of the gospel was to be heard? I could mention a number of other things. An attempt made to reform the legal system, an attempt to create a new university at Durham, which didn't quite come off in the end. It didn't happen until the 1830s. Now, in May 1657, Cromwell made his most important and arguably his most disastrous decision, which is he refused Parliament's offer of the crown. So we never had a King Oliver. It was his belief, actually, that God had abolished monarchy in England and that he would be rebuilding Jericho if he were to do that. If he had been crowned, his reign would have been all too short. In August 1658, it became clear that he was in decline, that his favourite daughter, Betty Claypole, had died just before, and the grief was intense. And again, he took comfort from Philippians, "I can do all things through Christ, which strengtheneth me." And he succumbed to malaria, septicemia, a trying urinary infection, and his spleen was suppurating. On the 3rd of September of that year, on the anniversary of his great military victories at Dunbar and Worcester, and in his own 60th year, God's Englishman gave up the ghost. He died secure in the faith that had sustained him while eking out a precarious living on land that he rented from someone else, through personal tragedies, and then in vigorous manhood as a soldier and statesman. Among his last words were these: "Lord, though I am but a miserable and wretched creature, I'm in covenant with thee through grace. It's not my design to drink or to sleep, but my design is to make what haste I can to be gone." And ever since that time, the plain russet-coated captain has been in the presence of the one king that he knew that he could trust. They do say that no man is a hero to his valet. Well, John Maidstone, Cromwell's valet, said at his death, "A larger soul hath seldom dwelt in a house of clay." Just a short postscript. The Commonwealth lasted only two more years. Charles II was restored to his father's throne, and a restored monarchy and Anglican establishment began to take its revenge. Cromwell's body was disinterred. It now lies actually underneath the pavement at Marble Arch. If ever you go there, you can look for a plaque and you'll find it there. His head was hacked off and exhibited on a pike staff outside Westminster Hall. It's pleasing to think that it now lies buried close by the chapel of his old college at Sydney, Sussex. For years, his reputation suffered at the hands of royalist historians until it began to recover because of a generous tribute by Thomas Carlyle. In a recent poll of men of the millennium, he came in the top half dozen. In the final years of the 19th century, it was proposed to enhance the House of Commons with a series of statues of the monarchs of England. But complaints from the then large number of Irish MPs meant that the plan to include a statue of Cromwell inside the House of Commons was scuppered. So in his tercentenary year, 1899, it was finally agreed to place his statue outside the House of Commons, outside Westminster Hall, actually. And there it stood ever since. And it's curious to think that during the Blitz, when fire and explosives rained on England's capital, the effigies of her monarchs were behind stout walls of stone, and outside stood the effigy of the Lord Protector, dressed as a colonel of horse, sword in one hand and Bible in the other, facing the enemies of England, stout and ready. He would have liked that. He would also have read much significance into the fact that his statue did not receive even one scratch from enemy action. Thank you, you've been most patient.